I have started and exited multiple companies. I am an avid investor in early stage companies. I advise some of the hottest startups and have worked with many of the top tech companies across numerous industries. I'm a software developer by trade, but I also have an MBA from Duke University. I seek out companies who defy conventional wisdom to drive innovation in any industry. And in this podcast, I interview the founders of those companies for you. Hello, folks. I'm joined today by Philip Wegner, founder of Secure Edge Networks. I've enjoyed every conversation I've had with Philip. He's super smart, very driven, and seems to really have a vision for his company and his industry. Philip, thanks for joining me today.
Thanks for having me.
So, Philip, can you tell the listeners what Secure Edge is?
Sure. So, we're a technology company. We're somewhat of a startup, even though we've been in business for 13 years. And we're this weird hybrid of a, what we do mostly is just help companies make the Wi-Fi work. In a lot of cases, we're doing that on subscription. And I think kind of the market's changed a little bit around Wi-Fi and to where people are used to buying things on subscription. And so we have...
So what's a typical customer for you? Because I think everybody knows what Wi-Fi is, but I don't think I appreciated just what a big business this actually is and how someone like you needs to exist, right?
Sure. Yeah. Well... If you think about when you went to college, which for you and I were probably a really long time ago.
It was a very long time ago for me.
Did we have Wi-Fi back then? When we were
no, I remember getting my first Wi-Fi in 03, and I graduated from undergrad in 2000.
So. Okay. We're dating both of us. If you think about a college campus today, Wi-Fi is the number one amenity at a college campus. Mm-hmm. And all the lesson plans and things in the school have gone online. And almost every business is the same way. So if you look at a retail location, let's say a department store, they've got applications that are all wireless. They're running on mobile devices. They have guest access in the store. And so that just means that in the old days, like back when you and I were in school, Wi-Fi was a hotspot type service where, it's in the cafeteria or in the library. And today it's like power in a building. Like
it's ubiquitous. It's just everywhere.
Yeah, it has to be.
It's the same SSID. It's not 12 different networks.
Well, no, it depends on the customer and it depends on the security we have to set up. And there's a lot of things that go into that. But those are all things you have to plan out. It sounds, I don't want to get too technical with it on the podcast, but those are all things you have to think about when you're planning a system like that.
That's great. I did a stint with a company that I helped launch called NextGrid, where we would blanket an entire city with Wi-Fi. And it was really eye-opening to me just what you could do with Wi-Fi. I mean, we experimenting with unidirectional antennas and very high power radios were able to get Wi-Fi going 5-10 miles point to point.
It's really where amazing. We live in.
Yeah,
that's where I live in.
That's great. I've even seen there's a startup in Charlotte, Smart Sky, that I think actually beams the equivalent of Wi-Fi into airplanes.
Well, they have a technology that's a ground to air technology that works off of cell phone towers, from my understanding.
Gotcha. Okay.
It's essentially how GoGo Internet is on. It's a replacement for that essentially.
Gotcha. Yeah. They were demoing. We did some work for them around blockchain strategy, but they were demoing and showing.
Those guys are smart.
In the air, like watching, like on a Skype call, watching Netflix.
Amazing. And, yeah. No, that's the technology we need. I wish I had that on the airplanes I travel on.
Yeah, exactly. So what did you do prior to starting Secure Edge?
Well, I don't know how far back you want to go, but I actually studied youth ministry in college, believe it or not.
Oh, wow.
My dad's was a Baptist minister growing up. And so I think when your dad does something, you just assume you're going to do the same thing. So that's really all I knew until I went to college. And then when I went to Liberty University.
Okay.
And then I met some guys who were actually in business. So it turns out business is not evil. It can be a good thing.
Some of my friends that.
Well, no, it's so funny. The environment you're raised in. My father made a lot of his decisions based on money. But he was a minister, right? Because the people in the church that had the money are the ones that really control the church. So it was really interesting perspective on the inside.
I didn't even think about that.
Yeah, no, that's the way it is. Like, and I don't know if you went to church growing up. Or
We did. It wasn't a big part of my life, but we had a church that we went to. But it wasn't core to the experience.
I was there Sunday morning, Sunday night, Wednesday night, until I was 18 years old, until I left my, and that's just the environment I grew up in. So, but it was interesting to see the influence of money had on the church. Mm-hmm. And so I had that perspective. And then when I got into college, I met some guys who were in business who were good guys, Christian guys and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. I was like, man, this is interesting where a guy can, be successful and be a Christian. This is so weird.
Yeah,
you know, it turns out you can do a lot of really great things. So mm-hmm. I, when I left school, I got a job in sales cause that's really all I could do. And then I was pretty good at it. Mm-hmm. And I just moved from company to company. And then the thing that's not on my LinkedIn profile is I was around during the dot-com boom. I don't know if you were.
I was. I worked for a company that built part of eBay. We built BarnesandNoble.com.
Oh, wow.
Pets.com.
Wow.
Pets.com. Yeah, yeah. We were right in.
And you were the boom.
We were at the epicenter of it. And it was funny because this particular company, not to get too sideways, but I interviewed with them in November, got my job offer in December, and then I joined them in July.
And then when'd you get laid off?
Well, so I went through six rounds of layoffs without laid off. But they, during the time between when I interviewed and accepted the job and joined, they had sold for $1 billion. They were a 300-person company at the time. They sold to CMGI, which I don't know if you remember CMGI. They were the fastest-growing company in the history of NASDAQ and the fastest-collapsing in the history of NASDAQ.
Oh, my gosh.
Capital Marketing Group Internet. They owned Excite at Home. They owned Navipath. They owned a whole bunch of web companies, and they ended up buying this consulting company, and they doubled its size within 6 months of me joining it, and then it collapsed. So it went to 600 people. sold for $1 billion. The management company or the management of the company ended up buying the company back for $18 million 3 years after selling it to them for $1 billion. So it was a wild time. So yes, I remember the .com boom and collapse very well.
I was just getting started in my career. So I had a couple jobs with fast growing technology companies. One of them raised $2 billion.
Wow.
And it was called Telligent, and it was a wireless broadband product. And it went to nothing.
Sales for them, or
I was doing sales. Yeah, that was really all I could. When I got out of school or when I left, I was like, I started youth ministry and a little bit of business, you know, but I can probably do sales. So I literally just got a job, 21, 22 years old, mm-hmm. in sales, and then I ended up riding the technology way for a couple of years. But I was part of the same thing where I was at a company that raised $2 billion, and then in 2.5 years, I watched them ramp up and ramp back down.
Yeah.
So the calls on a Friday, hey, we have a Monday morning mandatory meeting, and then you show up Monday morning, and then just the axe falls.
Yeah.
And your boss raises his hand. Hey, they let me go, and you know they literally stack rank the reps. And I made it through a lot of those reps. What's that?
What year was that?
2003, I guess.
Yeah, that was about when everything started to unravel.
I think about that time. And then I ended up being at two or three different startups in a period of a year.
Wow.
And they all ran out of money. So I would go there, and 90 days later they would announce, hey, we're not going to.
Was this in Charlotte?
In Charlotte,
okay.
Yeah.
Got it.
It was a really interesting time to be.
Now
start your career.
From looking at your LinkedIn profile, did you spend some time at AT&T? Do I have that correct?
Well, yeah. So after I got laid off a bunch of times, I finally just like, well, I'm going to AT&T. Well, at the time, AT&T was losing $2 billion a year back then.
Yeah, and they had AT&T and AT&T Wireless were actually two separate companies.
Yeah,
right?
Well, I was at the AT&T Enterprise, the business services or whatever. And I hated it, but I stayed for a couple of years and kind of rode that out. And the way I ended up starting a company is I had some people that I'd met early in my career, that approached me and said, hey, we're starting a company. Mm-hmm. We'll make you a partner, which really meant a sweat equity partner with no control.
We're going to pay you less. Yeah, yeah.
and you make no money. Yeah, that's right. we're going to pay you nothing. We love your skill set, but we don't want to pay you. So we're going to make you a partner. And that's how I ended up, owning a little slice of a company under sweat equity terms. And then
what did that company do?
They were doing wiring and phone systems.
Okay.
Which is,
so not VoIP, but it was,
well, it was VoIP,
it was VoIP,
but it was just you go into deals where people are selling wiring. I mean, like wiring in walls and stuff. And I thought at the time that the future was wireless. Mm-hmm. And that the opportunity was in Wi-Fi or wireless and data security, because that's where at the time everybody was afraid of wireless.
Yeah.
So I thought, hey, we could build this company around building secure Wi-Fi systems. And that's where I named the company Secure Edge. And I went to these guys and said, hey, I need to go.
Yeah.
and that's what I did.
So, what were the, you say that you saw what you thought wireless was a big thing. What were the trends that convinced you, like what things were happening in the business world that you said, hey, this wireless is the way to go?
Well, first of all, I was too early. This is before we had iPhones. We didn't have iPads. This is 2005 when I'm having this. So I was too early. So looking back, they were right.
Yeah.
Right? But I thought that there was a trend towards wireless. And what we were seeing more and more is that there's a lot of applications that are moving to mobile phones. Mm-hmm. And things are going mobile and the environments that we were seeing. Because we were doing business with, hospitals and schools and even car dealerships. We're having these, starting to deploy these big Wi-Fi systems. Yep. So I thought there's a big opportunity. If we can go in and build these big secure infrastructures and they're fast
and secure as the desktop, though, was the main thing that you were thinking of connecting, or what were you thinking of? What were there other things that you could see coming back then that were going to connect?
No, I wish I was that intelligent. I'm not really sure. I'm not sure what I was thinking at the time, other than I think this is a great opportunity. What I was seeing is I was going into opportunities where the wiring projects, if you will, were getting bid at $30 an hour, and there's no way you can make money that. Meanwhile, I would see these big airport Wi-Fi projects, and they were billing $200 an hour for these resources. So it was easy for me to see, hey, this is the direction we should go in.
Yeah,
because that's really where the opportunity is.
Yep. And what was the state of wireless security back then? I mean, we were on web, not even WPA, right?
Yeah, I think it was mostly pre-shared key. The advertised speed was 54 meg.
Wow.
Which means you're getting 24. It's crazy how much, now we're doing gigabit and a half.
Well, it's funny. I remember when gigabit Ethernet was a big deal, right?
Yeah, that's right.
What's the current Ethernet standard up to?
Get up to 10 gig, but most people aren't doing 10 gig mm-hmm. to the desktop or to the person. They're doing 10 gig building to building, things
okay,
like that.
Okay, got it. It's kind of a backhaul. Okay.
Yeah.
What trends happened after you started that you maybe didn't foresee? What were some of the big things after you started that started to change in terms of what people were realizing they could do with this new technology?
Well, so a lot of people ask, because we've evolved over the years. So when I started the company, we were primarily doing large-scale engineering projects. We would go into the Vegas airport, for example. We did that project, Terminal 3, when they built that mm-hmm. multi-billion-dollar project or whatever. And we would go in and we'd do all these high-end engineering services. Well, what we realized is that we would leave these systems, configure them properly, and everything worked great. We go back 18 months later, nothing works. Well, yeah. The software's never been updated. The customer's never logged into it. It's never been kept up to date. So we're like, well, somebody's got to manage this, mm-hmm. Why don't we offer managed services? So we started, it was really an evolution from engineering into managed services. And then as we started doing that, we realized that.
So just to pick that apart a little bit. So before you would come in and you charge for a project, we're going to come in and build it for you. And then you walk away and maybe they happen to call you and say, hey, can you come look at why this isn't working?
That's correct.
And you flipped it to a managed services model where it's a recurring contract where you're providing services and they're paying for those on a monthly or an annual basis.
Well, that's what we came up with originally was, hey, we're going to do managed services. And that we started doing that about 2014. That was the evolution. We would go in and just give them the stuff. Mm-hmm. And then they wouldn't call us until they said the Wi-Fi sucked.
Yeah.
Well, the Wi-Fi sucks because it's never been updated.
Yeah.
It's evolving, but a lot of things happened. So personal devices came out mm-hmm. and you and I update our iPhones every 1.5 years, maybe 1.5 to 2 years, 2 years max, probably.
Yep.
So
I'm not buying the new one. That thing's ugly.
You're not buying the new one?
This will be the first year I haven't done the upgrade.
I'm such a dork. I always buy the latest stuff.
I always do, but I just, have you seen the pictures?
I have not, actually.
Three cameras. It looks awful. Yeah. Sorry. Go ahead.
Well, no, it's like, what else can they add to the phone?
Yeah,
it's evolved so fast.
Yeah.
I mean, I remember my first phone was like the little Nokia phone with the little buttons.
Oh yeah. I had one of those.
And I was,
I remember having two analog phones before they went to digital.
Did you, the StarTAC?
I had a StarTAC and, what was the other
StarTech
one?
StarTech was actually, you were badass. If you had
the StarTech. But the StarTech retailed for like $1,400 at the time when it first came out. I was selling cell phones back then.
Oh my gosh.
And then the other big one was the Razr. That was a real game
changer. Yes, the Razr was awesome.
Yeah, it was. Those were both awesome phones.
Did you have a RIM device?
I did. So I had the I had the Bold and the predecessor to the Bold. I think it was called a Trio.
I had the RIM, and now we were the coolest people because in meetings we could pull it out and like.
Oh, you had it back when it was a two-way pager.
Well, no, the two-way pager RIM. Yeah, like the one you wear.
No, I never
your
had
belt.
That. I wasn't cool enough for that. I did. I did have a.
Yeah, at the time,
beeper too.
At the time, everybody wore their phones in their belts.
Yeah.
Now I think you you're a 40-year-old virgin if you wear.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. I saw someone wearing one on a plane the other day, and I was like, "That's old school, man." That and the fanny pack.
Throwback.
Yeah, yeah.
Throwback. That's funny.
I don't remember how we got there.
Well, we were just talking about evolution. So yeah. what happened is in the kind of the Wi-Fi world is that personal devices start coming into the network, right? Yep. So if people are changing their devices all the time, the technology on the devices is changing all the time. So the network infrastructure can't last for 7 or 10 years, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
The technology on the Wi-Fi side has to change to keep up with the things that are connecting to it.
Yep.
And
correct me if I'm wrong, but the access points weren't designed to have hundreds of devices originally.
Originally, no.
But now you've got, I have probably 40 devices in
my
house.
Gosh.
Now. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, no, now you've got all this, MIMO stuff, you know, so you just got a lot of capabilities to get a lot of devices on at the same time.
And what is the limiting factor there? Is it the connections have like a set amount of memory, and so the access point eventually just memory leaks itself, and that's why it needs to be reset? Or?
No, it's actually maybe in a home router, yes.
Okay,
but in a corporate environment, usually, literally the access points we're installing today, like the ones that we install, have two computers in them. I mean, they're crazy. It's funny. When we first started doing this, they had this kind of appliance that you would use called a controller.
Okay.
And it was hardware based. And that was, we still use those in some scenarios, but the access points, they have more power than the controllers had.
Wow.
When we start, like not even close.
Okay.
So now you have these like literally two PCs inside an access point. What you have to think about though is that it's splitting bandwidth.
Okay.
So the limitation is
it's just
the more people are on, I'm splitting it, that many times, and it's getting slower and slower.
Yep.
And then there's other things that are more technical, sometimes the slowest device slows down for everything else.
Okay.
So there's a lot of things that impact it.
Got it. So you mentioned your service offerings went from we're going to come in and do a project to we're going to have a managed service. Has it evolved since then? It sounds like you kind of hinted that, well, we started with managed services. So how has it evolved?
Well, so what's evolved is all our devices are mobile. The primary way we connect to the network is mobile. The applications we use are cloud-based. So your CRM's in the cloud, your, whatever's in the cloud. So to us, that means Wi-Fi is like power. And that's kind of the critical thing. The other thing that's happening is there's an explosion of IoT and all these other things that are hitting the network, which just means that if the network is like power, I really have to put it in and monitor it and keep it up to date all the time. And so what we saw is a trend towards SaaS models. Mm-hmm. And we were having conversation with customers, and they would, and these are like, let's say a large manufacturer, and they have a critical app that's going to work in the warehouse, like a warehouse management system or ERP.
Yep.
And we would say, oh, that system's going to cost, $200,000 or $300,000. And the guy's like, I just want to pay a monthly bill, and I just want shit to work.
Yeah.
He's like, I tell you what, I'll pay you monthly, and you just make it work.
Yep.
And so what we realized is that we really need to wrap this into more of a SaaS type model. So we spent a lot of time and money on software that converted into a subscription. Mm-hmm. We had to figure out the financing side because I don't want to go raise $100 million to finance equipment. I really want it to be built into the deal. So we had to figure all that side, how we're going to do all this, because now we have this huge hardware purchase we need to make with most customers. So we had to figure all that stuff out, but we converted the whole thing to a subscription.
That's awesome. So you've moved them from any CapEx to this is a pure OpEx play.
If they want to, you still have the people. When people, it really depends on when the customer is buying something. If they're buying when they're building a building, a lot of times they have a lot of capital, and they'll want to buy what's on site.
Gotcha.
So when we deliver these solutions, there's a hardware component that we have to put on site. Obviously, it's expensive. Then we have software that we have to use to manage it and things they need, like the. Like splash pages in a Starbucks. Like we built one of those. We have our own product that we built and we include that with it. And then there's the managed services port. So sometimes they'll pay for the equipment and then the subscription is just on the services and the software.
And so what would the capital spend for a hospital be? I mean, I know it could vary, but I'm just college campus.
A lot of it's driven by square footage, right? Okay. So let's say it's a mid-tier college with 2,500 students. It's probably $900,000-ish, for equipment. And a lot depends on the layout, right? Because I might have... The more square feet, obviously, the more coverage area you have to have. So it's a lot driven by square foot.
And if I've got an older building, I might...
That can impact it.
The building materials, obviously.
Yeah, but probably 10 to 15%. Okay. So in an older building. You've been to my office, and it was an older building with, who knows what in the walls, a German manufacturing plant. So it does impact the performance some, but not significantly.
Okay, got it. So are there particular, you mentioned hospitals and schools, are there industries that you focus on? You mentioned retailers, are there other industries or?
Well, we do. We've always had a lot of success in, when you think about anybody that has a critical application that runs on a mobile device, that's who a good customer is for us. But traditionally that's been higher education's a big portion of our business. Medical certainly is. But the two that are really coming up for us, well, really three markets that we're getting pulled into a lot of deals are manufacturing or warehousing markets. We're starting to do a lot of retail now because they're moving to the Apple type experience where they have an in-store person walking around with a mobile device and all that kind of stuff. So we're doing a lot of that type of stuff. And then we're getting involved in a lot of large hospitality.
Now, on the retail side or across the board, are you doing a lot with beacons as well? Is that part of your offering then? Or
it is, but that's a whole category. It's really interesting, mm-hmm. and there's a lot of people that have been in that space for a really long time. But think of the infrastructure layer like you think about your phone. Your phone has hardware and software on it, and then it's got applications that are layered on top of the hardware software. Wi-Fi infrastructure today, that's the way we have to look at it. And so what we're putting in is we're putting in this hardware software layer that's got a lot of really cool information in it, including the beacon technology, which gives you locations for users and all that kind of stuff.
And for the listeners, most people have heard of beacons, but these let you really, with the GPS application and the GPS radio on your phone, you can get to within 10 or 20 feet. But with beacon technology, you can really get down to the inch level. So when you're locating somebody, you don't just know that they're in the store or near the store. You know that they're on aisle 6 at this section.
And if you have a lot of beacons, you can.
Yeah.
But it comes down to how many you're going to put in a store. But in general, that's true. And you're seeing a lot of resorts, like really large resorts, use it for wayfinding where you have an app on your phone that's showing you where you are.
Yep.
You see that a lot in medical environments.
Very cool. But that's not something that is necessarily in the wheelhouse. It's not the same. You're not selling the same kind of experience or app. That's much more dependent on an application, presumably.
It is. Yeah. It's the application that's sitting on top of the infrastructure. Okay. But these are debates we're having internally, though, of what are the things we should be building and what are the things that we should be buying.
Gotcha.
Some of the things that are really easy to do that we already have the capability to do are just around analytics, like around your business. So if you imagine you had 50 retail stores and you wanted to know how many people are at the store at any given time. That's actually data that we can pull right off the network.
That's cool. Very cool. And are those applications common across all industries? So when you think about building those analytics and the value that you can add, is it pretty distinct to a given customer or to a given industry, or are there a lot of commonalities?
Yeah, so you mentioned retail analytics, for example. There's a lot of companies that exist just specifically in that space. And it's all about creating the digital experience in the store, marketing to the user based on what their interests are, all that type of stuff. But I think that there's a need for business intelligence across all industries. Mm-hmm. And I think that we have to think about what's the data we have access to and what are the cool apps that should be sitting on top of the infrastructure.
And so you can get access to that just from the Wi-Fi connectivity, or do you can get that without even digging into the application layer, even though the application is running over the Wi-Fi, but it's you're strictly looking at number of connections that are made, how those connections change over time, that sort of thing.
You can get all that right away. The interesting thing is when you start tying identity to the person who's connecting. Okay, so for example, you go to Starbucks. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you're probably not as much of a dork as I am, although you might be.
You might be the
geek that I am. But if you read the terms of service.
Okay, you win.
I won. Okay, so I'm more of a geek. If you, it, when you, at least when you sign in, it will say you have to sign in less because we will remember you more, is essentially what it's saying.
Interesting.
What it's doing is when you sign in with your email address, it's tagging your laptop to you as a user.
Okay.
And so now when you go in, hey, John's here on Tuesdays and Thursdays, they know when you're there. And yeah, they're, what they're doing is they're looking at things like how, what's your spend.
And do they tie that to like your IMEI, or is there some, what are they, or is it a cookie that they're tying to? Do you know how they
identify? It's just the MAC address on your device. It's the MAC address. All you do is when you sign in, you register, yep, and it takes your email address and then signs in with your device. And got then your, and that's the traditional retail. Like these, and that's old. Like that technology is
there for a long time. To do.
But it's interesting if you thought about that from a business perspective, because you know what your average spend is. Guaranteed they have demographics on you. You know, they know like what your age range is, all that type of stuff. And then if you don't show up for a while, they can choose to send you a coupon in your inbox. So
interesting. I didn't even think about that, but that does make sense. And they were very forward thinking in providing giving users access to Wi-Fi. And I guess that's why, because you
well, there's those are the two amenities you have, right? You have it's coffee and and Wi-Fi, right?
So what type of companies do you partner with? Obviously, you've got some hardware companies that you partner with. You mentioned financing, so I'm assuming there's banks that you partner with. But what does your ecosystem look like?
So that's a long discussion. But to build the products that we have, relationships with different banks, because we're financing the gear and stuff like that, we incorporate different technologies in our stack. So we're vendor agnostic is the way that we look at it, but we certainly view ourselves as a doctor. So we're recommending a solution that's gonna be for you.
Okay.
That's gonna be a good fit for you. We primarily work with Cisco and Aruba as the two technology stacks that we like to work with most often.
Yep.
And then our software that sits on top of either one. So it doesn't really matter which platform we're using. We can manage it.
Very cool.
Yeah.
So obviously Cisco and Aruba, two big brands. How do you think about your own branding? And then does it have to be consistent with the companies that you partner with? Or do you think people are buying, obviously, the whole solution, but do you think the software is the brand? Or how does all of that work in your mind?
I think the solution is the product. Mm-hmm. So Secure Edge Wi-Fi is the product. And whether it's Southwest flies a certain type of plane, but Southwest is the brand. They're delivering a service. You know what I mean?
Yep.
So AT&T uses a Cisco router, but it's really an AT&T service. Mm-hmm. So when I look at our business, I've got engineering services that we provide. I've got a service provider solution, and that's really what we're talking about right now, where the whole thing's wrapped into a subscription, or mostly wrapped into a subscription. And I think that's a service, and that's the brand.
Very cool. So did you sit down and think a lot about branding? I know you, when you started the company, you said it's got to be secure. I'm going to put secure in the name. But how often do you think about branding, and what does that process look like?
Probably not as often as I should. Mm-hmm. We have thought a lot about marketing. I haven't really thought about what kind of brand I want. Well, actually, that's not true. We have thought a lot about how, now that I think about it, we have thought a lot about it. I'll back up a little bit. We started marketing online, like doing like blogs and content in 2009.
Wow.
So we were really early to the, I don't know if you follow like HubSpot and the inbound methodology game.
Absolutely.
We started doing that in 2009. So we have over 1,000 blogs and articles.
And really, you get a mind blowing number of hits every month. I mean, you get a lot of,
I mean, tens of thousands.
Yeah, that's awesome.
Tens of thousands. I mean, I think the most we've ever had, and so it's all relative really, was like 120,000 hits in a month.
Wow.
Which for us was a lot, you know. Cause when I first started doing it, I was trying to scale the business. I hired a sales guy, and he was like, you know, Phil, we don't have any leads. And so I put this software on the website, and we had like 34 web visits in a month.
You better convert 100%.
Not that day, in a month.
Yeah.
And so I was like, oh man, we really need to figure this out. So I started doing it way back then when I was the one writing the blogs and stuff like that. And it's a good strategy.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Content-based marketing is huge. And account-based marketing and automating all of that. I've come to see that religion, you know, I've come to practice that religion for sure.
So
how is the mix of revenue? as a percentage of subscription versus the older model changed? Are you at a point where it's 100% subscription now, or do you still have people that you mentioned that some companies will want to do a CapEx because they're building out a new building? What's the percentage breakdown there?
So, we started doing managed services in 2014, but we really didn't understand how to structure it right and all that kind of stuff. I started building software to do all these things in 2015. Okay. So, and that was, and you and I have had a couple discussions on that.
I think
that.
I met you in 2016.
Yeah, well, you were like, what the hell are you doing? Or no, you looked at it and you're like, oh, you said in like a few words, I was like, oh, that is what I'm building, you know? So that was a learning experience. Me on the phone with a Russian developer, 18 months straight, every morning at 7 a.m.
Wow.
So you can imagine the awful software that we built.
Yeah.
But we, so we started building software in 2015. We really didn't figure out the whole financing model and everything like that until 2017.
Okay.
And that was really when we figured out, oh, wow, this whole thing should be a subscription.
Yeah.
And we should offer it this way. So in 2016, 70% of our revenue was hardware project-based revenue. 2017, we saw a tremendous shift. In 2018, our revenue grew by 65% over 2017, and 75% of our revenue was subscription-based in one way or the other.
Wow.
So it immediately flipped. I mean, within 24 months, it went from, you know, primarily one-time projects, because people understand that Wi-Fi is critical, right?
Yeah.
I mean, you don't deploy Wi-Fi because you want Wi-Fi. You deploy because I've got an ERP application that must work. And if it doesn't work, I can't check an inventory and I lose millions of dollars.
Yep.
So you want that stuff to work. So, and that those are the types of customers that usually pay for, you know, a service like ours.
That's awesome. And do you see a world where you get it to where it's 100% of your revenue?
Oh, totally.
Sold that
way? Well, what I was going to say is, our evolution was we actually bought a software company because I was building terrible software. We bought a software company and we've really invested heavily in having software tools. So it'll be really interesting to see what we do in the next 6 months, because now we actually have service provider tools. And then the question is, what's the best way for us to scale that? Is it for us to do everything ourselves? Mm-hmm. Or is it for us to help other people be service providers?
Okay, interesting.
So there's some really interesting things that we're considering right now that I'm not sure how they're going to play out yet.
I'd be surprised if you did. That's my takeaway from talking to a lot of successful people, is that most of them don't know where things are going, but they're gonna manage that process.
They'll figure it out. Yeah. Sometimes you have to survive long enough to figure it out.
Yeah. No, that's great advice. So, what have been the biggest challenges in scaling and evolving the business through the years?
Jeez, that's a its own podcast. when I started the business, I started it upside down immediately. And that's a long story, but when I decided to leave this other company, the guys that were there came to me and said, hey, why don't we just sell this to you? And I'm like, okay, well, what am I getting? Well, what I ended up getting is a lot of debt, a note from the company that we had to their company, you know, so it was just an idiotic decision that put us upside down. And what it did is it really limited my options. Now, by that, I mean, I couldn't go raise money. All the smart guys like you come up with an idea and you go raise money and you fund it for a period of time and you're a lot more strategic. I literally, from day one, had to go sell enough to pay the bills. Mm-hmm. And then hopefully pay myself like that. That was bootstrapping.
Yeah. So having that kind of a constraint actually probably forces you to run the business better, and actually turns out to be a good thing.
It absolutely does. Yeah. So it's so funny. There's sometimes it's like, let's say you're building a software product, for example, and you go raise millions of dollars. Well, first of all, you have to think about where you raise the millions of dollars from and what they want, because your life is now different. The second you raise money, you're now holding to somebody else. And I've seen guys get kicked out of their own businesses. I've seen all sorts of stuff. Yep. And so you have to think about that. But that also means that you lose a certain amount of control. But if you have millions of dollars, you're gonna have a lot of pressure to move really fast. And when you're still evolving your ideas on a software product specifically, for example, you don't necessarily want to move fast. you really want to think through a lot of your ideas, in my opinion, test those with customers, and then start moving. If you'd have given me $1 million to build software in 2015, I cannot imagine the awful crap. Yeah, yeah. I had to learn how to do that. Yeah. I guess the flip side argument of that would be if I could have afforded to have somebody like you with me,
yeah.
You know, we could have had both the software and the sales.
Well, it's a tough one, and it's you're talking about it in the context of having the resources, but even just building software, regardless of the resources that you have, somebody building the software has a vision for where they think it needs to go, and that has to exist, or you wouldn't have great companies. You have to know where you want it to go, but at the same time, you need feedback from customers, and so it is a constant question of how far do I build this on my vision versus how do I react to the customers? Because if all I did was put it in front of the customers, they don't know what they want. So there has to be a spark, but then how far do you take it? And I don't know that anybody knows the answer. The current answer is, and it's why we have agile methodologies, is to get a minimum viable product, get it in front of a customer, and then let your vision kind of co-evolve with what how the customers actually end up using it.
I think the hard part, so I think if you're a startup, your MVP needs to be better.
Yeah.
Whereas I think if you're a big company, your MVP needs to be really good.
Yeah.
If you're a smaller guy, you can go to the customer and say, hey, I'm working on this.
Yep.
You know, you don't have the big brand. But I think that's the debate, is how good does the MVP need to be?
Yeah, yeah. Well, and how far do you take it on your vision?
Right. Right.
Like at what point do you say, okay, this is enough that a customer can kind of can understand what we're trying to do with it, and then start to give you feedback? And it's a tough one for sure. So. Were there any big jumps in Wi-Fi technology that created what you saw as just a very clear threat or opportunity, or was it just kind of an evolution, or was it not the Wi-Fi technology, it was more the applications that sat on top of it? Or
a whole bunch of things happened. Like, since the start of the company, we now have mobile everything, right? Mm-hmm. So that drives the adoption, and obviously Wi-Fi, everything has to be Wi-Fi at that point, or most things. And then every 4 years, a new Wi-Fi technology comes out, and the speed more than doubles.
And so, is N the latest?
No, actually, we're way past. We had ABG to N. Mm-hmm. You had AC Wave 1, AC Wave 2.
Yeah.
And now we're on AX.
AX,
which
okay.
is the, you
Jeez,
know.
I'm behind the times.
But I mean, but being past AC, I mean, you were in close enough to the wired speeds to where mm-hmm. wire is always going to be faster than wireless, right? Because you have to contend with all the airwaves and stuff like that. It's a wire.
Yep.
When you went to AC, now you had speeds fast enough. You're like, you know what? I'd rather have freedom on my mobile device than I would plug in.
And how does 5G change the landscape for you, or does it?
It doesn't really. So if you look at what the FCC is doing, the FCC is making more bandwidth available for Wi-Fi, and they're also making more for 5G. I think all that means is just our applications are going to get faster and more bandwidth hungry.
Okay,
that's all it means. And you're still going to have both. But the way that I look at it is 5G is primarily an outdoor technology.
Yeah.
And then Wi-Fi is primarily, you know, an indoor technology.
Well, it seems like one of the things that 5G should do is push more things to the edge, right? Which might make the Wi-Fi even more relevant.
Well, it will, and that's when you're gonna see all the advancements in self-driving and all those types of applications.
Yeah.
But I mean, you're seeing these city systems where they're putting in smart grids. I mean, that's the world you came from, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. So you talked a little bit about it, but how has the cloud impacted your business?
So I just think it was a driver to convert people to go Wi-Fi. Mm-hmm. I mean, my wife's a college professor, and all their services are online. If the network goes down, they can't take tests, you know.
Wow.
So all that's online.
Yeah.
So I mean, it just means that there's more and more reliance on what we do, which is good.
That's awesome.
It's good for me.
That's awesome. So where do you see your company going in terms of growth over the next 5 years? Both in terms of, you mentioned 65% growth in revenue. Is that sustainable for you over the next 5 years?
I think when you're small, I think you always ask, when people like throw out all these growth numbers, it's always 65% of what?
Yeah.
You know, if you're 165% of revenue last year, were you $1 million last year? Or were you $10 million last year? You know?
Yep.
I don't necessarily want to grow that fast, because I think that might break a lot of things, especially when we move into a subscription model. But I'll tell you that we raised a little bit of capital recently, which means that I bootstrapped it for 12 years. Then we raised a little bit of money. We raised a little bit of money mostly because I wanted to scale properly. I wanted to start ramping up a sales team. We had to make a couple more investments in product. And then I wanted somebody behind me that knows more than I do.
That's always helpful.
That could help us, you know, scale the business. So that's what we went out and that's what we got. So like literally a year ago, I was the only sales. I was the only, I'm really part-time sales, but we're literally just a bunch of engineers. Like it's network engineers, Wi-Fi engineers, security and software. Like that's almost the whole company.
Yeah.
So last year it was literally just me as the sales guy. I had one inside sales guy and a couple marketing folks. This year we hired a director of sales. I've got a handful of enterprise, like really good enterprise sales execs. We've got an inside sales team now. Mm-hmm. So we're in the ramp up mode.
So you're planning for growth.
We're going to grow. I mean, yeah. we are. Yeah. I mean, we it took us forever to get the model and get the software and all that stuff. Right now we're scaling.
So are there things that you envision dramatically changing in the model, or do you think you've got that to a point where you're going to continue to improve on it, but it's going to operate roughly the way that you've got it right now? How does that look over the next 5 years in your mind?
I don't think the solution stack of what we're doing is going to change. It's always evolving, so we're going to do more and more. Like we're spending a lot of money on business intelligence type things, like we were talking about earlier, and I think that's going to just create more value for the subscriptions with the customers. What I think is going to change is our go-to-market strategy. Like I think what my mind has really been opened up to is the AWS model, right? Mm-hmm. Where AWS built servers for themselves and they built a cloud for everybody else.
Yep.
And so there's some of those types of things that I'm thinking about, and we'll see how that plays out.
Yeah, the AWS model is interesting, and it isn't just AWS that they do that with. Every single part of their business is modular and serves internal, and then they open it up to the outside world. And I think that's brilliant, because when you look at the auto industry through the decades, they go back and forth between vertical integration and then breaking it apart and integrate the supply chain. But then what's historically happened is, once you vertically integrate from top to bottom and you have captive customers, there's no competition. And so they end up having to break it apart and go back and forth. And Amazon has the answer, which is, we'll vertically integrate, but every single one of those pieces will sell to
That's
competition
right.
as well. And that forces you it's to crazy. Be competitive. It's a brilliant model, really. So what tech do you think is going to be the most impactful to your business over the next 5 to 10 year time horizon?
What tech?
Yeah.
I would say software more than... I think that, like I was talking about earlier, I think the way that we're going to look at infrastructure is going to be different over the next few years. Mm-hmm. And when you look at like a lot of the hardware that's being deployed, a lot of the hardware that's being deployed for networking has APIs.
Yeah.
Well, so the way I think about it is, what's the cool shit we can pull off the network that gives me business intelligence data or things I wouldn't otherwise have?
Yeah.
So I think that's where it's going to change. So I actually think that the changes in the hardware is going to be like the phone, to where, you know, you're not upgrading your phone because your phone's already really good. I mean, there comes a point where it's like, do I need 4 cameras versus 3? You know, I don't
more
take
selfies. Is always better.
Come I don't on. Do selfies. So maybe if I did, maybe I'd see more value in that. but it's all really good. I think you're going to get that point with Wi-Fi speeds, for example, where you're like, okay, you know, I've got a 10 gig Wi-Fi. I can't do any more on my device.
It's funny. We were doing some work in the DevOps space, automating infrastructure, and we did some work for BB&T. And I remember they took a process that used to take 6 weeks from start to finish. So the coders would be done with the program, and they would say, now let's put it into production. And it was 6 weeks on average to get it into production, which, when you think about lean and agile methodologies, if it takes you 6 weeks before you get it in front of a customer, then the customer uses it. Now I want to go build and make some changes based on customer feedback. Now I've got to wait six weeks. It just doesn't work very well. And this isn't singling BB&T out. It's anybody who hasn't invested in DevOps and is doing production scale deployments is going to have a similar story. But we took it down to an 18-minute process through automating with a tool called Chef.
What?
And, yeah, and now you can just imagine what a game changer that is.
But the software?
It's software, yeah. So basically what you do is you take all of your configurations that would normally they had a wiki page that had instructions for how everything needed to be deployed and configured, and you would just copy and paste those commands into a command line and run the script. And then there were approvals that had to happen. And because there's all sorts of things that can break in that copy and paste exercise, you have all sorts of audit processes that are going in there. And so I can make a change to a router configuration to make sure that a port is open so that two components can communicate to one another. But you have to then have a process where an auditor comes in and looks at something. And so we literally just automated all of that in a script that just runs on a scheduler. And because it's a computer running everything and not copy and paste, there's no auditing that needs to be done.
Right,
it's just
right.
done. You know, the computer isn't going to make a mistake.
Right.
So, but it was funny because I thought about it and I was like, wow, that's amazing. And then I said, but if we had gotten it to an hour, that would have been fine too. Right. And I know the way that software vendors work, I'm sure that we could go in with the next version of Chef or the next product that's similar to it and get it down to 5 minutes and then get it down to 3 and get it to 2. There's just a point of diminishing returns where it doesn't matter.
And the
tech vendors themselves don't want to hear that because they want to keep putting, and it's the same thing with Apple. I'm going to put a third phone now. I'm going to put a third camera on my phone. Now I'm going to put a fourth. And there's just a point where it doesn't work. And there's a guy named Dave Asprey, Bulletproof Coffee guy.
Yeah.
And I think he's the one who I first heard talking about it. There's a minimum effective dose at which point you don't need to go beyond. Like, why go beyond the minimum effective dose? You're just, and in some cases it starts to harm you. And I think that tech vendors have a tendency to do that for sure.
Agreed, 100%.
Yeah.
You were asking about how our industry or how some of our stuff's going to change. Mm-hmm. One of the things that we've been working on for the last 2 years is if you think about like the hierarchy of needs for a customer, there's some sort of business process that needs to be fixed, mm-hmm. right? So they've got a warehouse, they've got a retail store, and in that retail store, they have to be able to do point of sale and all those other types of things. And because of that, they have an application that they purchase or build. Mm-hmm. And then that application, because they have that, then they deploy Wi-Fi, right?
Yep.
A lot of times when people find us, they're having some sort of problems with the infrastructure. I don't know what the problem is. Is it my system itself? Is it my software? Like, what's the actual problem when people say the Wi-Fi sucks or when our application is failing? And so what we started figuring out is if you paid us thousands of dollars to go out on site, which is, you know, people pay a decent amount for us to show up on site, we show up with like tens of thousands of dollars in software tools, all this kind of stuff. We would walk around these networks and we would do troubleshooting. And what we realized is my VP of engineering like 4 years ago was like, it's really dumb in today's world while we're going out to a site with a person.
Yeah.
And then we're troubleshooting in that period of time, which means the 45 minutes we're there,
yep.
you know, things look great, but Wi-Fi is dynamic and it changes. So like, he was like, it'd be great if there's a way for us to extend our team to the locations all the time.
Yeah.
And so what we started working on is what if we could build essentially a computer board that would automatically run the tests that we would run if we were on site. And then we could automate a lot of that troubleshooting process.
Yeah.
And we did that.
Okay.
So it took us a number of years because the computers were too big. Now we have, you know, Raspberry Pis and other things that are smaller. We're not using a Raspberry Pi, but that's an example of a single board computer. And we're doing a lot of that automation now. Yeah. So it's interesting because now you're able to literally be on every network that you're.
We had to do a lot of that at NextGrid because we. For instance, in Marblehead, Massachusetts, they wanted to connect 10,000 electric meters onto the smart grid. And we deployed, I think, 500 or 600 essentially Wi-Fi access points that all communicate with one another.
Wow.
And they also have Zigbee on them. But they get installed on the top of light mm-hmm. you know, the actual street lights.
Mm-hmm.
And to install on a street light, you've got to dispatch a bucket truck. And so if we want to, if we want to do any physical tinkering, there's got to be 2 union employees dispatch with us.
Yeah.
It's expensive. So we were forced from day one to build a solution that was self-managing. And that was a lot of the software that we wrote, not just how do we make all these devices communicate, but how do we make it so that we can control these remotely and get reporting remotely. It took a lot of time to get that right. But I think that is the future of any IoT type of application.
Of
has to be self-managing, self-healing.
Yeah. Yep.
So how much of the innovation for your clients, we talked about this a little bit, but how much of it comes from you saying this is what you need, and how much of it is them seeing the art of the possible and saying, can you come drive this? Man, I know it's not one single answer, but.
It's definitely a mix of both. Mm-hmm. One of the advantages we have, because I was doing sales with us for so long, I was going to talk to the customer a lot. In a lot of cases, I still do, and I really enjoy that. One of the things that I talk to the team about internally is we always talk about solving for the customer, and we want to be able to deliver what is it they need, like a doctor does, you know, like a doctor would recommend some sort of fix. And so a lot of the things that we're building today did come from meetings with customers, where they're like, hey, this would be cool if you could give me this data from our infrastructure. Can you tell me how many people are going into our facility at any given time? Yep. Well, that's interesting. Yeah, that is interesting.
I didn't even think about that.
So there is a lot of that. And you can also look and try to figure out what customers have tried to do themselves. Mm-hmm. You know, because sometimes you'll show up somewhere and the customer's already built something. Mm-hmm. Or they're trying to build something, and you're like, oh, that's actually a really good idea. We could build that at scale, you know?
Yeah.
So it's a little bit of both.
Okay. So you mentioned that you raised some outside capital, and you talked a little bit about why you did that. And part of it is you wanted someone who compliments you, and you might have worded it as smarter than you, but generally, how do you go about seeking outside advice or outside help?
I find guys like you.
That's bad advice to start with, for the record.
No, I just look at what I... So it's not just people, right? I mean, we're doing a podcast, right?
Yep.
So I think a lot of people, when they get out of school, they're like, oh, I went to school for a business. I'm ready to go.
Yeah.
And I was in a meeting with some of my team a few weeks ago, and one of the guys was like, well, we don't know how to do this. I'm like, well... what does it have to do with anything?
Yeah. We're going to learn.
Go freaking figure it out. Like, do you think I knew how to start a company? When I started a company, I bought a book on how to incorporate your business in North Carolina at freaking Barnes & Noble.
Yeah.
And I read it, and then I did it. Right? Yeah. I didn't go to school for business. I think because I'm greatly self-taught, not totally, but I consume 1 to 2 books a month.
Yep.
I listen to a lot of podcasts. I just had this, I had this tremendous desire to learn and grow. Yep. And I look for people on my team that do the same thing. So a lot of things I've learned I love hanging out with guys like you, but you're busy as shit.
Yeah.
And so like, you know, if I have a software problem, I can't just call John and say, hey, you know what I mean?
Yeah. Absolutely.
Cause you're running your own companies, you know? So, I've learned as much as I can on my own. And then when I reach a sticking point, I reach out to people that I respect or try to meet people that I respect.
Part of that goes into that is not knowing, like I'll go out and have conversations that I don't know how it's ever going to benefit me. And because I have that mindset.
Yes, you
know?
Of course. Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. So, actually you're a great example. You came to my office. You probably don't remember. And you gave me 2 hours of free advice.
Yeah.
You don't remember that.
No, like,
that type of stuff is really valuable. And that means a lot.
Yeah.
And that means that I will help you. And I would help you anyway. You know what I mean? Like I try to help other entrepreneurs get businesses started and things like that. But if there's a lot of guys like you.
I mean, but man, that's why I do that though, is because I don't know where it's going to benefit me, but I know this much. Like I have a smart friend named Philip who I can call on when I need something, right?
Exactly.
Like,
exactly. Yeah. But I also think that there's a lot of guys out there. And Charlotte's got a lot, like Keith Ludeman. I don't know if you know, guys like him are in the market that really want to help people. My investor, I literally just cold emailed. Now you couldn't do that if we were in Silicon Valley, but we're not, we're in Charlotte. Yeah, so, absolutely. You know, there's a lot of people that, untapped resources, I feel like.
Here. So do you have a formal board at this point now that you've got an outside investor or how does
it's go? Just me and the investor.
Okay. Got it.
At this point, maybe we'll do that in the future with more, but right now it's just us.
Yeah. That was, I have a friend, Steve Amedio, who runs TKXS, used to be Techniques, and Techniques. He's had to form a formal board and get really, really structured about it. And he really, used to get on me a lot at Level about not having a board. And my answer was always, we'll do that when, you know, when the time is right.
And
the,
did you ever do it?
We never did it. And it's my biggest regret in that whole experience is that we never did it. And the size that we had gotten to, and that it is now, it's hard to do it after the fact. It really yeah. is. And it's one of those things I would encourage you to think about it and treat it as if you were a company that's 10 times the size that you are yes. right now. And think about building it for that. Again, it's hard. And I never did it because it wasn't, it's never going to be a priority is the real problem until it needs to be there. So,
it's interesting you say that because, the last 6 months for me has been a big learning experience now that we took on a little mm-hmm. bit of cash. Because now I have somebody else.
Yeah.
And I, you know, if you've been single for 12 yeah. years and all of a sudden you're married, you know, it's yeah. a little bit of adjustment, you know, and that's what's happened like that. But it's been a learning experience and I'm still learning, mm-hmm. but I think a board would do for us. And I think that's where we're headed is it would grow us. It would make me grow up a little bit.
Yeah.
And run it like,
and again, I say that again, full disclosure that I never did it, but yeah. I wish I had. And
yeah.
moving forward, it's not a mistake, but it's something that's going to become needs to be a priority.
Yeah.
That I force the issue on, not that, you know, that I do as for some external reason.
Yeah.
I think a lot of people think, oh, when I raise a big round of funding, someone's going to come in and say, you have to create a board. And that is true, but I think you're better served
doing it on your own,
doing it on your own and thinking about it.
That's good advice.
So can you talk a little bit about mentorship? How you go about finding it for yourself, which we already talked a little bit about, but then more, how do you allocate your own finite mentorship for your employees within the company?
Wow. When you were at level at any of your businesses, when you brought people in, did you do personality tests?
So we did a DISC profile.
Yes.
And we brought in a consultant to do that. And
yep.
it was mind-blowing to me how useful that exercise was.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah. And that's a hard one because should you do it on every single employee, it probably would be helpful. For us, we had just gotten to a size where I realized none of us knows one another, really knows right. each other because none of us were working together
yeah.
until a couple of years ago, you know, until maybe 6 months in some cases. So we have done that.
So
we never went to where we did it.
Gave everybody tests and then how did you incorporate the information in your day-to-day work?
So in this particular case, we took our top 20, maybe 25 managers in the company, and we went offsite to Asheville and we spent a day with the consultant. First, we took the DISC test ahead of time, and he presented the results to everybody and organized us into four different groups based on optimizing those groups to demonstrate the power of DISC. And then yes. we solved some actual problems while we were in there, and we talked about some actual things. And yeah.
yeah,
I mean, it was a paid engagement. It was not yeah. cheap. This yeah. was a professional who
yeah.
he used to be the COO of Medtronics actually.
And, wow.
He's just a change agent.
I love that
yeah,
stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. It was definitely cool. But yeah, so wow. did we do things with it afterwards? We never really followed up with it, but I do think it changed the way that we operated with one another because we knew, okay, different personalities respond to different things. This is going to cause pain for this person because it's fundamental to who they are that they need right. to be in control of these type of details.
Yeah. So when we are onboarding people, we always give them that test. I actually give them a personality test before we hire them. Now
I've heard of people doing that, and it sounds awesome to me. But
I do it because you need to know coming in. If your operations person isn't very detail oriented, that might be a problem, right? So like, sure. I want to know those things, although I found that not all the tests are accurate, which is a whole nother thing. But what I was headed with that is my own personality is I have a lot of deficiencies, okay. if you could say, and that I have a very strong personality mm-hmm. and I have to work on empathy, for example.
Yeah.
And
empathy is not my strength.
I'm very driven, which means I a lot of times I'm focusing on the work that I'm doing, and I'm living in a tunnel, if you will. Mm-hmm. And so I have to really be intentional with the people that I hire and put around me, because I've got to hire them to fill in my holes. And I think the what I love about the personality tests as you're kind of building your organization is you need to think about, a lot of times we talk about diversity and stuff in the workplace, and diversity is extremely important. And it's important both, traditional race and things like that. And, but it's important for mental diversity.
Yeah.
So, we've got a couple older, people on the team, and that's good.
Yeah.
Cause you don't have a bunch of 23-year-olds, right? You want to have age diversity in your team. You want to have, gender diversity in the team. You want to have, racial diversity, and you want to have personality diversity. And that's one of the things I've learned a lot, because I will run like a train down the tracks and not even look at what's going on around me.
Yeah.
And so when I've hired other managers, I've hired people that have much more empathy with people. That also means that sometimes the way I communicate is much different than the way they communicate. And that's the hard part.
Absolutely.
So I don't know that I'm a, I've worked with some people and coached them on starting businesses and things like that. And I think that I've been helpful in those areas. But I wonder how good I am as a manager. I'm not sure I'm a very good as a manager. And, and mostly because I'm so busy doing the things we need to do.
Yeah.
Because I don't have enough people or to do all the things that I need to do. So I'm working.
Yeah.
A good manager puts out a plan for his, his direct reports. He's got, or she's got a way to develop them and things like that. Yeah. I'm just not.
So your approach to mentorship is whatever is needed by what needs to be done, like kind of real time, just in time mentorship.
Yeah. Exactly. My approach to mentorship is add mentorships to add other people who can mentor people to the business. that's my approach.
So talk to me about how you go about building culture within your company. Cause your office is awesome. I mean, it's one of the more thoughtful designed offices that I've been in.
And
I know you spent a lot of time on it, but it really shows in how you built it. Is that just because you wanted to build a great building? I'm assuming that ties into the culture that you want to build, right?
There's a lot of cultures out there, and you kind of have to decide what's a good fit for your business. The culture that we have is very much a team environment. I would not say it's a family environment. I would say, I don't know if you read the book, the Netflix book. They're a little bit cutthroat, but there's a really good book on culture
I've read. The Netflix had a real famous PowerPoint deck.
That kind of spells out their culture.
It's great.
But whoever that lady was, I can't remember her name. But I read that book. It's really, really interesting, their culture. But they have a team culture, right?
Yeah.
And we want to show up and get work done, have a good time, and then go home. We don't have an environment where we want people to be in the office 24 hours a day.
Yeah.
We really want you to spend time with your family. Yep. But we did try to build a space that we were very thoughtful in the way we built it out.
That's really fucking cool. That's what I'll say.
Everything from like the building we're in and, when I designed at the office, I did think through things like sit stand desks and all that kind of stuff. And then I literally spent a lot of time with the architect trying to figure out how everybody in the entire workspace could face windows.
Okay.
So like if you'll notice, like all the offices are glass, and then there's barriers that we have, but they're not barriers that block light.
Okay.
So like there's a lot of things that we did that were very intentional. And I enjoy that stuff, but it takes me a long time to do it,
Well, and are you've got a shared workspace inside of your office, correct? Is that?
Yeah. So we're in a building off of Wilkinson, which was an old German manufacturing plant, and it was converted. And then some developers spent millions of dollars right before the fall getting it converted into more like office style condos.
Okay.
So when we came in, we bought as much of the building as available, and then we since bought more of it.
And that neighborhood's just blowing up.
Well, fingers crossed that the light rail will go down Wilkinson.
Oh, wow. Because that's part of the plan?
Well, that's been the discussion is where's the light rail going to go to the airport?
Okay.
And the logical, it's got to go down Freedom or it's got to go down Wilkinson. Wilkinson's a straight shot.
Yeah.
So we'll see what happens.
I guess it could go down Graham and intersect down and kind of lower south end. I guess that would be the other.
It could.
But that would be kind of.
Yeah.
Silly, since the uptown, you want it to hit the uptown.
No, it's going to go area. Wilkinson, man. Yeah. Stop. I'm just kidding.
Well, but that's it. If it goes
to
uptown,
coming up with
it
ideas.
Has to go Wilkinson.
It's going to go down Wilkinson. No, we hope it does. But either way, my business is going to be going to be there for a while. So yeah, I bought as much of the building as I could. And then the third floor, I turned into the launch factory.
Okay.
And that's a shared space. And what's great about that is Secure Edge can bleed our growth in and with Launch Factory. Mm-hmm. And what's also great about Launch Factory is, you know, we've got a bunch of software companies in there already. Yeah. We literally just got, it's a long story, but we got the really officially open in July. So mm-hmm. I've got a lot of that stuff very going cool. on, which is really cool.
So I come from much more of an app dev background than networking or wireless. What do people like me usually get wrong about wireless networking or about the world that you're in?
Well, I don't know if you get wrong. I just think it's always a debate of why isn't the application working?
Yeah.
Right. And so I actually think this is where the future's headed. Like in a server environment or in the cloud environment, we have a lot of tools that are on our servers that are monitoring application performance, right? Mm-hmm. So I'm monitoring how fast my e-commerce cart is loading. I've got software that's simulating an end user on my website. And then if anything is slow, I'm figuring out what the problem is. What we're building on the Wi-Fi side are those same tools.
Okay.
From the inside of the network.
Yeah.
So the sensor that we built, we have a piece of software that we loaded on called User Experience IQ,
okay.
UXIQ. And what it does is we have the ability to do that same workflow. So we can simulate a browser activity,
okay.
connect to an application, load some pages, and then report on the whole thing, and then say, hey, is the problem the network or the application when there's actually an issue? That's so great. I think it's I don't know if you guys get it wrong. I just think there needs to be better integration between the applications and the infrastructure, because that's what the infrastructure is there for.
Absolutely.
Is to support your application.
Yeah. Yeah.
So like there's gotta be that level of visibility.
I agree. I think the convergence of those two, and there's a lot of other things that I think you could have the same conversation or philosophical discussion about. I mean, it's I tend to think of systems as a series of bottlenecks.
Yeah.
And it's natural to just address what is the it's a very effective thing to go say, what is my current bottleneck? Well, it's the hard disk. Okay, put a better disk in.
Right.
Now all of a sudden I see there's a new bottleneck. It's my network. So okay, right. Let's improve the network.
Yes.
Now my software is not taxing either of those, so I probably need to do more with my software. So it's the bottleneck. But I do wonder, is there a more holistic way of looking at things? And I think it's easy to just solve. It's a very repeatable process to just go after whatever the biggest bottleneck is, and you don't waste time chasing things that you may not fully understand.
Right.
So, but I do wonder, even though that's effective, is there a more effective way to look at things kind of more holistically? And I don't know the answer to that, but I think that's one of the interesting challenges. Well,
that is interesting conversation, because if you look at some of the products like AppDynamics and stuff mm-hmm. like that are looking at the applications like down the database level and figuring out where the problems are.
Yep.
If those types of tools were more integrated with the networking, then you'd have a full end-to-end visibility on what's going on. What we did is we created the sensor, and then we created a piece of software we're calling TestBot,
okay,
which is the made-up name, that we're loading on the server where the applications are hosted so that we can give that visibility. So we can test from inside the network into the actual, on the server where the actual software exists, the application exists.
That's great. That's great. Well, this has been great, Philip. I've enjoyed our conversation, and I definitely look forward to our next one. Before we go, is there any technology out there you've got your eye on that you think will create the next $1 billion opportunity?
If I knew that, then I wouldn't be sitting here talking. I'd be making $1 billion.
So you're working on that application right now.
Yeah, I'm working on that right now. We're in stealth mode. I'll let you know when we're raising money.
Very cool. I figured I would ask. I ask all my guests. So. All right, Philip. Well, thanks. Cheers.
Thanks, John.